Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with historian Douglas Brinkley about his new book, American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. It's a great pleasure to welcome historian Doug Brinkley to The Reading Life. Formerly at the University of New Orleans and then at Tulane, Doug is now the Catherine Sarnoff Brown Chair and Professor of History at Rice University, as well as a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a CNN official historian. He's written numerous presidential biographies, as well as books about Hurricane Katrina, The Great Deluge, a biography of Walter Cronkite, and histories of the environmental movement, such as The Wilderness Warrior and Rightful Heritage. Today, we're talking about his new book, American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. Doug, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you, Susan. I'm thrilled to be on with you.
This book is such a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. How long have you been working on this? It's massive.
I mean, you know, Susan, I was I grew up in Ohio, and even though I was born in Georgia, I grew up in Ohio in a little town called Perrysburg, and just down the road from me was where Neil Armstrong was from, the town of Wapakoneta.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 8 and a half, going on 9, when Neil Armstrong went on the moon, and I was just enthralled like everybody. But in my case, it was a local boy made good. He's walking on the moon. I collected all sorts of NASA memorabilia and the like. And cut to me being in New Orleans in 2001, I had earlier written Neil Armstrong saying I wanted to interview him, and he politely declined and said, I'm not really doing interviews, but I'll keep you in mind for something down the line. And lo and behold, I got a call from NASA inviting me to come and interview Neil Armstrong with the late historian Stephen Ambrose. The two of us went there, and I was able to ask any questions I wanted to Neil Armstrong for a number of hours. That was in 2001, and I've been working on this story on and off because I've done a lot in between ever since then. It's important to know that because I teach at Rice University. That's where John F. Kennedy made the famous speech of September 12, 1962, which we call the Why I Choose to Go to the Moon, you know, speech. And it's a memorable one. It was filmed in color, and it's one of Jack Kennedy's best presidential moments.
I know, as an alum myself, I was kind of thrilled to read that about JFK and Rice Stadium. That was really fun.
You know what they just did at Rice for me? They got from NASA the original JFK podium, which was in a museum, and they wheeled it out into the middle of the football field to the exact spot where Kennedy gave the speech, and they allowed me to stand behind the podium to get the feel what it was like when Kennedy spoke to 40,000, largely students and Boy Scouts.
What a thrill. Now, Doug, that's your gift. to bring history to life.
Well, it's this book, Susan, I had a great deal of fun writing. One of the big boons I had was the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston has slowly been releasing Kennedy tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And now I was able to get access to the 1963 tapes when you hear Kennedy with James Webb of NASA, the director, talking about Apollo, talking about, is it worth putting this many chips on going to the moon? And that's what's so extraordinary. Why did John F. Kennedy put so much money, $25 billion, $180 billion in today's terms, on this idea of beating the Soviets to the moon?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were times when it was not clear we would have a budget appropriation for such a thing, but Kennedy kept banging the drum. Lyndon Johnson did the same in many ways, using the martyred assassinated Kennedy as the reason to fund his dream. And it occurred, the big moment, the Eagle landed on the moon July 20th, 1969. And this summer we'll all be reflecting on that 50 years later.
Oh, yes. Now, there are so many strands to this story. And one of them is that it's such a story of technology, of the way space technology for exploration grew out of wartime technology. And one of its central figures was the very controversial Wernher von Braun, who came to the U.S. by virtue of his expertise in missile development in wartime Germany.
Well, that's, you know, I really write about Wernher von Braun a lot.
Yeah.
Because he's the same age of John F. Kennedy. So I was looking at Jack Kennedy's time in the Solomon Islands during World War II in the Pacific. But Wernher von Braun was this genius, wunderkind rocket engineer that Hitler globbed onto. And they had a top-secret base along the Baltic in which he would do rocketry experiments. The Third Reich funded it, and eventually von Braun is the one to put a rocket into space, 62 miles straight up to lost Earth's gravitational pull. He then perfected his rockets to becoming the V-2, and the V-2 wreaked havoc on London and Paris and Antwerp. The cities were just hit by these rockets. And the United States in World War II put a lot of money into the Manhattan Project for atomic bombs, but Germany had the rocketry experts. Well, after World War II, or at least once when Hitler went in his bunker and committed suicide, von Braun cleverly took and hid all of the blueprints for his rockets, all of the war materials, all of the essential parts. These were train cars full of materials, found a hidden cave and blew up, dynamited the entrance. And then they disappeared, von Braun and about 130, 40 of the top German rocket scientists into the Bavarian Alps. And von Braun sent his younger brother, Magnus, on a bicycle looking for U.S. troops, and they surrendered to the U.S. Army. Von Braun did not want to go to London, where surely they would persecute him for war crimes, plus the British were broke. Nobody wanted to go move to Russia at this period, so he made his bets that he would get the best deal with the U.S., and he did. The Truman administration shipped all of these Nazi rocketeers to Fort Bliss near El Paso, Texas, and von Braun started testing his missiles, the reconfigured V-2s and improved versions, on the White Sands Proving Grounds in New Mexico near Roswell. And by 1950, von Braun was moved to the Army base in Huntsville, Alabama, where he started building his moonships. He is the person who built the Saturn V that brought Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to the moon.
What a survivor he was. I mean, it's an amazing story.
He was a survivor, Susan. And you know, there are people that wanted to charge him with war crime because they used slave labor at the Dora camps. But he escaped those charges. He became a bit of a born-again Christian, or at least professed one, and became a dutiful servant to the U.S. Army. All he was about was purpose of building rockets. He was an Einstein of rocketry, and he kept perfecting them. What many people don't know, after Sputnik in 1957, when the Soviets put the first man-made satellite into space, that Eisenhower went with the Navy Vanguard rockets. Well, the Vanguard started collapsing at Cape Canaveral on the launch pad. And by the time of 1960, and it certainly once Jack Kennedy becomes president, he grabs on to the Army and says that von Braun's the one that's going to build the rockets. And I write about this relationship that Kennedy and Wernher von Braun developed.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about this book is that it shows how important the American South, Florida, Alabama, we think of the Stennis Center in Mississippi and the Michoud facility here, as well as the Southwest. And of course, Rice and Houston, too, were to the space program.
Big thing that I learned from writing this book, Susan, is this point. That, you know, John F. Kennedy, a Democrat, he first won his congressional seat in 1946. He never lost an election. He won in Congress in 46, 48. By 1952, he runs for Senate and wins. 1958, Senate wins. 1960 president runs and wins. So a lot of this is about winning. But JFK saw Truman as a bit of a failure. And, of course, he didn't like Eisenhower. He's a Democrat. But FDR had done the Tennessee Valley Authority, had built the Grand Coulee Dam, all of these WPA bridges and tunnels and the like. Eisenhower had built the interstate highway system and the St. Lawrence Seaway. Kennedy's big infrastructure program became technology, particularly space technology and rocketry. And consciously, Kennedy, who barely held on to the South in 1960, decided to pour a lot of money. Some people call it pork, but smart government investment, either way you want to call it, but into, just as you said, into San Antonio, Texas, for space medicine, the manned space in Houston. You mentioned in Louisiana and Mississippi, they're doing testing grounds and building facilities. And so Louisiana and Mississippi both benefited from going to the moon financially. Alabama with Huntsville, Florida. You get the idea. It was kind of a southern strategy of technology. Mm-hmm. And so the Southwest and the South were huge beneficiaries of NASA in its heyday. By the 1970s, the technology revolution is Silicon Valley and then Seattle. But the Midwest kind of gets cut out on all of this. You don't get a lot of 60s, 70s, 80s tech dollars flying into the Midwest. Hence, in some ways, they're trying to catch up away from the old industries, smokestack industries and manufacturing, into creating new high-tech corridors.
Mm-hmm. Now, John F. Kennedy was the perfect president to articulate the dream of space exploration. I mean, when he announced his bid, he said, "I love this so much, Doug. The American by nature is optimistic. He is experimental, an inventor and a builder who builds best when called upon to build greatly." So given the times we're living in, I imagine it was kind of a daily pleasure to write about a president who was so relentlessly aspirational.
It was. It's the contrast between Kennedy's optimist and the politics of fear and division of today are quite astounding. Keep in mind, Jack Kennedy barely beat Richard Nixon in 1960, yet he had a public approval rating through most of his presidency to 60 or 70%. It was an era of bipartisanism in Capitol Hill. So it's not Kennedy who brought us to the moon, it's America. Many Republican senators signed on for the moonshot. Most of the astronauts were Republicans. John Glenn got cherry-picked by Kennedy to be a Democrat, and he eventually became a U.S. senator from Ohio and almost an extended member of the Kennedy family. Ethel Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy's wife, told me that when her husband was killed in Los Angeles, she called John Glenn to look after her children at Hickory Hill in Virginia while she was going through the trauma. That's how close John Glenn became to Kennedy. But the big thing Jack Kennedy believed in was we can do it together, American optimism. Today, our country is hungering for what's the new moonshot. You know, incidentally, the term moonshot really got popularized by baseball. A Los Angeles Dodgers slugger named Wally Moon used to hit towering home runs out of the Los Angeles Coliseum, and baseball announcer Vin Scully called them moonshots. And the term moonshots tracked. Even there in Louisiana, when they were building the facility outside of New Orleans, their slogan was "From Muskrats to Moonshots." and the moonshot became a term really for American can-doism. So as I'm speaking to you, Buzz Aldrin's still alive. He wants the next moonshot to be a Mars shot. Joe Biden thinks the next moonshot should be collectively working on a cure of cancer. Democratic left thinks the new moonshot should be a climate change grid to confront it. The challenge, you know, Donald Trump has been promoting the wall with Mexico as a kind of a moonshot idea, but it's too hyper-partisan to ever become a true moonshot. To make something big work, you've just got to get everybody into agreement on it. And war tends to clarify things. We have a great World War II museum in New Orleans when we're all in it together. But at a time when we're not at war, how can we find some big project to do that makes us feel good about ourselves? And we don't have an answer to that right now, but we're searching for it.
Well, and I love the fact that so many people came together to make this legacy happen after Kennedy died before he could see it come true himself. I mean, LBJ was just as invested in the space program. Jackie writing that letter after he died, I found that very moving to make sure that the Moonshot program continued.
You know, exactly. And all of these engineers in America, I mean, the engineers are sort of the unsung heroes of my book. We sort of take them for granted. The big word in 1960, the word science mattered. Time magazine picked scientist as their men of the year of 1960. But the truth is, it's really engineers that take us to the moon. The engineers, they're building the skyscrapers and the modern transport systems of America. And we don't write about them so much. Well, you know, we're constantly dealing with presidents and senators and astronauts when we talk about space. But I try to at least pay respects and honor some of these extraordinary space engineers. And all of these universities that pitched in, Purdue University, has so many astronauts went there. Rice University, deeply connected with NASA. Caltech in California did extraordinary work. And there's a place, Langley in Virginia, where we did a lot of modern aviation work and tested anti-icing and wind tunnels and the like. So, you know, it was an incredible American endeavor. So many people participated. 400,000 people worked and were employed to get us to the moon and work with NASA. And that $25 billion has paid itself many times over because of technology developed, spin-off technology from going to the moon. Things like GPS, anti-icing in your car, CAT scans, MRI. I could go on and on.
Don't forget the dustbuster,
really,
Doug.
Great technology, yeah.
Now, I just finished reading Nathaniel Rich's new book, Losing Earth, The Recent History, about climate change and global warming. And one of the things you both write a lot about is the conflict between science and politics and scientists and politicians. And it's been with us for so long, we see with your book.
It has. Different presidents look at scientists in different ways. Theodore Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy were really believed as the scientific experts. And FDR in some ways, at least in agriculture, were going to lead us to a better America. Other presidents like Donald Trump are less inclined to trust scientists. They believe the scientists can be bought and people buy their scientific research to tell you two different things. I will just tell you, with climate change, NASA and NOAA are leaders in studying climate change. The advances of our satellite technology of John F. Kennedy are for weather purposes are really what's mapping the world, which is doing hurricane forecasting, which is recording the melting glaciers, which is monitoring water flow and flood levels. And so the work of scientists and engineers and space experts really have contributed to our planet in incredible ways. And I might add, when you're talking about the environment, many of the people I interview were all about mission going to the moon. Many of them were combat war pilots in Korea. They came out of the military culture. So they were mission driven to go to the moon. But many of them said their big revelation was seeing lonely, fragile planet Earth floating out there like a blue marble and realizing how lonely our planet was. There are no borders. You don't see man-made structures. It's just we're all on planet Earth together. And so an environmental movement was sprung by Earthrise, photograph and Whole Earth Catalog and the like. It became a part of that late 60s, early 70s culture to connect space and photography of the moon with the environmental movement.
Mm-hmm. This feels like a book you've been getting ready to write all your life. There's the grand sweep of it, the focus on a much admired president, the importance of people like Cronkite, whom you've written so much about before. And not only that, it's rooted where you are now in Texas at Rice. So did it feel different from writing your other books when you were doing this one?
Susan, what a marvelous question. The answer is yes. I never felt a book that I was meant to write quite like this one. I think it came out of my boyhood interest in NASA and space. It's been informed by that chance to meet my boyhood hero, Neil Armstrong, and interview him. The fact that I'm at Rice, which is just down the road from NASA, and this extraordinary document trove that the University of Houston at Clear Lake has, including amazing oral histories. The Kennedy tapes opened up right when I was working on this book, which means all the books before mine didn't have access to this sort of tape, you know, live stream of consciousness taping that Kennedy did related to going into the moon, the 50th anniversary coming upon me, and also I've learned some tricks of the trade of writing. I was determined not to have this as fat, as long, as heavy as some of my other books. It's also a large book, but it's not too large. I was able to find great photography because the space exploration, the NASA photography is great, but many great camera persons that work for Life magazine and the like took extraordinary shots. So I was able to make it photographically rich. I have a major color insert curated in the middle of the book.
Well, I love that heart. I mean, even though you know what's going to happen, it reads like such a thriller. And then you get to that heart-stopping moment when everybody stops to watch this, and you capture that moment right down to the bank robber who robs a bank and stops into a bar to see the moonshot and gets caught as a result.
It is. Well, everybody, the whole world stopped. We were in the middle of the Vietnam War. There was a lot of protests going on in America in 1968. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed and Robert Kennedy. There was turmoil. But for that July, there was a kind of calmness, and the whole world watched. Over 500 million people tuned in for Neil Armstrong's famous moment. And then it wasn't just going to the moon, but we brought them all back alive.
Right.
The truth of Apollo 11 is it was pretty much problem-free. Now, I could dwell on and do a little on a couple things that, you know, could have gone wrong and almost went wrong, but by and large, it was a great accomplishment. In fact, as soon as the three astronauts were retrieved at Johnson Space Center, or within the manned space center, Mission Control, they put on their big giant screen John F. Kennedy's pledge to Congress of May 25th, 1961, that we'd put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. They flashed Kennedy's words, and then on the other side of the screen in giant letters, task accomplished. You know,
we
think we remember a lot of big days in history, you know, Pearl Harbor, Kennedy assassination, 9/11. Those were all tragedy. The moonshot was an American success story. And hence, that's where the optimism comes from. We did it. We had a vision. We worked for it. It was a collective effort, and we achieved our goal. You know, today, the confluence isn't right. People are unsure whether to go to Mars, whether we go back to the moon. But for this frozen moment in 1969, the American flag was planted on the moon, and the flag is still there.
And such a moment of hope. Let's carry on.
Well, we always have to carry on with hope.
Yes. We've been talking with Doug Brinkley, whose wonderful new book is American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. Reading it was pure pleasure, Doug. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it.
On tap in the literary life this week. Sunday is the final day of the 33rd annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival and the 16th annual Saints and Sinners Literary Festival, both at the Hotel Mont Leon. Don't forget the Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest in Jackson Square that closes the event this afternoon. Award-winning Afrofuturist writer and best-selling author N.K. Jemisin reads and discusses her work with Lauren Weathers, including her How Long Till Black Future Month, Monday, April 1st at 7 in the Kendall Cram Room at Lavin Burnick Center, Tulane University. Daniel Jose Older appears in conversation with Veronica Roth, the author of the Divergent series, to celebrate the paperback publication of The Faith's Divide. That's Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Tickets available at eventbrite.com. Rachel Kadish discusses and signs her novel, The Weight of Ink, Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. John Biganay and Mark Yakich appear at a launch event for Interviews from the Edge, 50 years of conversations about writing and resistance, drawn from interviews with the New Orleans Review. That's April 2nd at 7 at the Collins Hotel, part of the 1718 reading series. Special guest, Helen Prejean. Flint Taylor discusses and signs The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago, Wednesday, April 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. C.S. Harris signs the newest entry in her Sebastian St. Cyr series, Who Slays the Wicked, Wednesday, April 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet Shayna Monet and Monica Mankin read their work in the Delgado Reading Series, Thursday, April 4th at 2 at Isaac Delgado Hall, Building 1, Room 201E, at Delgado Community College's City Park campus. Nathaniel Rich signs his new book, Losing Earth, A Recent History, after a discussion with WWNO's Tegan Wendland, Thursday, April 4th at 6 at Tulane River and Coastal Center. That's at 1370 Port of New Orleans Place. The Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities will honor outstanding achievements in the humanities Thursday, April 4th at the 2019 LEH Bright Lights Awards Dinner. That's in Lafayette at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Student Union, Thursday, April 4th at 6. For more information and tickets, visit leh.org. Among those being recognized is Daryl Bork, who is the Humanist of the Year. Bork served as Louisiana's second peer-selected poet laureate from 2007 to 2011, and he has published 12 books of poetry. The Humanities Book of the Year is A Cajun Girl Sharecropping Years by Viola Fontenot. Whitney Stewart signs her new children's book, What Do You Celebrate? Saturday, April 6th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Best-selling novelist Amor Towles discusses and signs the paperback of A Gentleman in Moscow. Tuesday, April 9th at 6 at the Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets available at octaviabooks.com and eventbrite.com. In Baton Rouge, Delta Mouth Literary Festival, a partnership with the LSU Department of English, the Southern Review, New Delta Review, and the English Graduate School Association, takes place April 5th through 7th at Louisiana State University. It's free and open to the public. The lineup of writers includes Joss Charles, Tia Clark, Jerrica Marchand, Megan McDowell, Carrie Messenger, Theory Mint, and Jeannie Venasco. Check out deltamouth.com for the complete schedule. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.